Welcome to the Moss Island Sounds podcast. This is our premiere cast. Is it cast or is this a pod? Anyway, we're sponsored this week by Finelli Sound and Lighting, a Utica, New York production company that can help you with your live sound and stage lighting needs. Joe Finelli's who I call when I need something, and you should too. Email me through the Moss Island Sounds website, and I'll get you Joe's contact information. Because this is the first episode, you might want to know something about me and what I'm going to cast about. Pod about? Okay, I love movies and theater, music, books, beer, good scotch. The novels of Susan Sontag are overrated. Sorry, it went Crash Davis on you there for a second. Anyway, I write to figure out what I think. I don't pull punches. They can get rough. You won't find any thumbs up or down here. Siskel and Ebert did more damage to media criticism than any other critics in history. I don't want to be some Consumer Report, should I see it or save my money type of reviewer. I don't have any use for the Rotten Tomatoes aggregate sites either. I want to engage people in conversations. I want to help people watch differently. Even a bad movie or play or musical or glass of beer has something good about it, something worth exploring. Well, maybe not that glass of bad beer. So Moss Island is a real place near Little Falls, New York, beside the Barge Canal. The island is 1,500 feet long by 625 feet wide, famous for very large potholes. Seriously, huge holes that were formed by melting glaciers over tens of thousands of years. It's like a geological playground. Rock climbers come from all over to scale its more difficult areas, and there are plenty of places on the island little kids can enjoy too. Moss Island was declared a national landmark in May 1976. You should go. This is how I became a critic. When I was 10 years old, I saw The Godfather on TV. I knew it was better than Star Wars, but I didn't know why. So I went to the library and I sat down with every volume of movie and literary criticism I could get my hands on. And I've been doing it ever since. The movie 50 Shades of Grey came out for Valentine's Day. I didn't want to go see it, not my kind of movie, although I have nothing against the subject matter. I think there has been a lot of criticism of both the books and the film by people who haven't read them or seen them. So here's rule number one. If you don't know what you're talking about, don't start. And I was surprised to enjoy myself at the movie. Here's the review. Let's get the movie review out of the way. 50 Shades of Grey is bad, not quite as bad as the book. Sometimes the filmmakers gently tweak instead of polishing the novel, suggesting a trashier, funnier movie that might have been. Dakota Johnson's very good. Jamie Dornan is terrible. The only spark between them happens when she's blindfolded. She can finally avoid his perpetual smirk. The writing is awful. Somebody allowed E.L. James to be an active producer, and she fought every effort to adapt and improve. But the photography's shiny and the music's inoffensive. Despite some critics griping, the sex really is sexy, but the movie's dramatic rhythm is slack, and those scenes play like music video interludes. A romance or sex comedy should have a robust structure to support the naughty bits. This film is little more than expensive softcore. And yet, when E.L. James's novels came out, I knew women who read them voraciously. Intelligent, well-read, functioning members of society have purchased 100 million copies in 52 languages. The movie's already broken box office records. Audiences are responding to something, despite the snarkiest efforts of critics like myself. We shouldn't dismiss the phenomenon. Certainly, sex is a draw, and many who wouldn't think about looking at internet porn seem eager for whatever Hollywood can deliver within the confines of an R rating. France's CNC rated the film PG-12, approving it for viewers 12 and older. Conservative pundits have been quick to cite the perceived dangers of BDSM sex. At the same time, BDSM advocates don't care for the movie. 50 Shades of Grey is not about sadism and masochism. It's a reverse fairy tale about an independent princess who rescues the damaged prince. The current movie is the first installment of a trilogy. I can't imagine another 4 hours of similar material. He needs to whip her because he had a rough childhood. She'll heal him in the name of true love, or at least in the name of commerce. As someone wrote, without the helicopters and fancy cars, she'd be out of there in a heartbeat. David Edelstein wrote for New York Magazine, "Newscasters and talk show hosts will squirm through discussions of BDSM with everyone reliably missing the point that in a country where almost every movie features a hero racking up serial killer-worthy body counts, it's a little slap and tickle that draws the most blood." His point is that nobody gets too worked up by Liam Neeson's latest Taken 3 or Denzel Washington's The Equalizer, etc. It's true. When I managed a cinema, parents would ask, "Is it rated R for sex or just violence?" France might be onto something. Last week, I saw Sarah Ruhl's In the Next Room or The Vibrator Play. In the late 1800s, the idea that women might find sex enjoyable was odd, and the concept of a device to bring them pleasure was taboo. I found myself wondering what the modern equivalent might be. Which of today's unmentionables will seem quaint in 100 years? Probably BDSM. Although research is beginning to emerge that consensual participation in such activities can be psychologically healthy, conventional wisdom says that BDSM is aberrant. Certainly, the movie 50 Shades of Grey leans towards unhealthy, at least in the first installment. If he were well-adjusted, it is implied, he wouldn't be doing these things. Plenty has been written about how unhealthy the protagonist's relationship is in this film. But isn't that what a romantic drama is usually about? The resolution of conflicts on the way to a happy ending? The movie makes every effort to give its heroine choices. The bulk of the plot is a literal negotiation for what each party wants. They draw up a written contract in what she will and won't do for love. The movie allows her to say no many times. But if young women see this, they'll start experimenting with S&M. Well, maybe. When a madman shot up a theater in Colorado during a midnight screening of The Dark Knight Rises, hotheads screamed that violent movies cause violent behavior. And one or two people who watch The Avengers will put on tights and jump off buildings. And some who watch John Grisham movies will become lawyers. I'd rather they experiment with S&M. 50 Shades of Grey is only slightly risque. As much as protesters fear that it will undermine the moral fabric of society, it's fairly conventional at heart. France got it right. Consider again, at least 100 million readers and record-breaking movie audiences. A truly subversive piece would not be embraced like that. Here's what I enjoyed, my fellow moviegoers. I sat by myself in a packed theater and listened. Reading is a solitary activity, whereas movies are communal. The reactions of those around impacts our own experience, which is one reason the texters are so annoying. They aren't watching with us. Two women behind me recited many of the lines along with the characters. There was plenty of laughter during the film, too, not just the tittering, uncomfortable kind, like when teen boys watch Judd Apatow movies. At the end, they protested the cliffhanger, and then they applauded. Not an orgy in sight. To borrow a phrase from Paul Harvey, next page. There's been a lot of talk in New York State about education reform lately. Governor Cuomo wants to double down on standardized tests to evaluate teachers, and he really wants to fire the ineffective ones. Now that sounds okay to most people. Fire teachers who aren't good at teaching. But in the ensuing conversation, it struck me that many people weren't discussing the heart of the issue. How do you really evaluate effective teaching? So I wrote this next piece, which started out about three times as long as it ended up. I kept whittling it down until it made just one point, maybe two at the most. I am a perfect example of a student who received tremendously effective teaching. It just didn't reveal itself in my attitude or aptitude until about 15 years later. Maybe I'll write a follow-up piece with some of what got cut out of this one, but this is a good place to start in any case. In praise of teachers, all of them. Give New York State Governor Andrew M. Cuomo credit. He's got us talking about teachers. The governor would make public K-12 teacher compensation commensurate with student test scores and fire ineffective teachers. Despite all the talk, many on both sides are missing the point. Effective teaching is not something that can be measured with tests or tracked on a spreadsheet. Consider this formula. 20% of a student's educational success belongs to the teacher, a qualified guide. 20% should be the responsibility of parental authority, providing food, shelter, and materials, vigilant against sloth. The remaining 60% rests on the learner. Most of us choose what, when, and how we learn. Teachers point out certain things and offer course corrections, but it's really up to us to put it all together. We know this. Holding teachers accountable for test results assumes they have far more control than they do, could, or should. Here's the fourth definition of teach in Merriam-Webster: to instruct by precept, example, or experience. I am the citizen, father, friend I am, not because of facts I memorized, but because I came into regular contact with men and women who shared their countless experiences and perspectives with me. They were highly effective, but no for-profit test-selling corporation has figured out how to measure it. I've had phenomenal teachers. I've also had not as phenomenal teachers, but I wasn't a phenomenal student either. I know I wouldn't want to stand in front of addled, indifferent, insolent idiots like myself all day. I was neither the best nor the worst they encountered in our comfortably middle-class, predominantly English-speaking school system. But I was a pain in the ass, and not even a particularly hard case. I took AP English during my final year of high school. My grade was at the bottom of the class, mostly because I didn't try. The AP exam was optional, and I had no interest because I didn't want to waste $120 on the registration. John Baines, highly effective instructor by precept, example, and experience, urged me to take the test. I refused. Finally, he told me to just show up because he'd covered the fee. Why? Because only 10% of students score a 5, and you're going to be one of them. Sure enough, when scores came in, mine was 5. Baines said, "I've made an investment in you. Don't forget this." I started college 15 years after that, maintained a 4.0 undergraduate average on a double major while working full-time and raising a family. I continued and earned an MBA. I've had several successful careers. None of these can be quantified, nor were they predicted by any teacher evaluation system I've ever heard of. I could tell dozens of stories about how my teachers made a difference in ways that had nothing to do with tests. They encouraged, they listened, they advocated, they shared their lives, they believed in me. That's what I want for my children, for every student in my community and throughout New York State. That's education.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Leonard Nimoy, the multi-talented artist who is best known as Spock from Star Trek, died yesterday. Our next piece is my recollection of what Spock and Nimoy's portrayal of him meant to me. I wrote this in about 30 minutes, immediately after I saw that Nimoy had passed away, so it's a bit unpolished. I am Spock. Rest in peace, Leonard Nimoy, born March 26, 1931, died February 27, 2015. The first time I ever cried at a movie was during Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. Opening day, June 4th, 1982. Tor Eklund, Tom Moran, and I skipped school to stand in line. Lowe's Cinema in Pittsford, New York. The single auditorium out back, which had the best sound and the biggest screen in town. We had no idea what was coming. Something like 600 people waited together on blankets, soda and coolers, Starfleet shirts and Vulcaneers and fanzines everywhere, but no spoilers. What a movie. By the time Kirk had turned the tables and defeated his old nemesis, played by Ricardo Montalban, with scene-chewing wrath to spare, we were emotionally drained and satisfied. Then.
Jim, I think you better get down here.
Bones?
Better. Hurry.
And I'm crying again now. The death of Spock at the end of Star Trek II was the first time somebody close to me had died. There were a few sobs in the theater, but mostly silence. The candy wrappers were still. Then Tom shouted, "Man, I could use some comic relief!" And we were deluged with popcorn. I grew up with Star Trek. My parents had a 10-inch black and white TV in their bedroom, and if I positioned the rabbit ears just right and put my foot on the cart, I could tune in the UHF station after school when they showed reruns of the original series, 79 episodes, which ran from 1966 through 69. Later, when I worked closing shifts at a movie theater, I'd turn to New York's WPIX Channel 11, whose after-midnight offerings included Star Trek. In elementary school, I had a Spock doll, action figure. How could an awkward, lonely boy not love Spock? He was the ultimate outsider, not only alien to his shipmates, but alienated from his own people because he was mixed species. Spock's father was Vulcan, his mother was human. He was devoted to logic and struggled with emotion. My perfect companion. Leonard Nimoy's single raised eyebrow remains with me today. And also the trademark scowl he didn't seem to realize was intimidating. Except maybe he did. The Vulcan salute, which Nimoy created based on a Jewish priestly blessing. Yes, Nimoy was also a painter, poet, playwright, and director. He famously wrote a book, I Am Not Spock. His characterization resonated so much that he rightly feared being typecast. But how many actors have been lucky or skilled enough to create one of the most iconic characters in the history of visual media? And Nimoy did eventually make peace with it. His 1995 memoir was titled, I Am Spock. Spock observed humans with a keen eye in all our folly and chose to live and serve among us anyway. He was first officer and best friend to Captain James T. Kirk, and sacrificed his life to save the Federation starship USS Enterprise, Constitution Class NCC-1701. And in the best Hollywood tradition, Spock was resurrected in the next film, which Leonard Nimoy directed. But not this time.
No! You'll flood the whole compartment!
He'll die.
He's dead already.
It's too late.
Spock!
Ship. Out of danger?
Yes.
Don't grieve, Admiral. It is logical. The needs of the many outweigh
the needs of the few.
Or the one.
Spock.
I have been, and always shall be, your friend. Live long.
Our final piece today is an old movie review, written in November 1987, when I was 18 years old, working at the YMCA as a latchkey counselor, watching two or three movies every night, all awkwardness preserved. Bonnie and Clyde. This is a really fun, funny movie. It's also emotionally devastating. It's set during the Depression, and it follows Bonnie and Clyde as they rob banks and kill people across the Midwest. At times, it's hilarious, such as when C.W. Moss parks the getaway car, or when Clyde tries to rob a bank that has no money and he insists the clerk tell Bonnie so that she'll believe it. The movie is a grand, exciting adventure. The gun battles and chases are well-staged and realistic. There's also social commentary if you're looking for that kind of thing, but the movie doesn't require you to think. There isn't a wasted scene. Everything just flows together, and the cinematography unifies and elaborates on the period and the movie's themes. The crowning touch of Bonnie and Clyde is romance. Sorry, guys, but it's true. And it's not just on the screen. The romance becomes personal as we in the audience come to care about these characters. It's significant that Clyde is impotent, because it removes sex from the emotional mix. Yet, its absence is looming, because maybe it means that Clyde is impotent in other ways, too. Maybe we all are. Bonnie and Clyde love each other, and their love gives weight to the shift in tone later in the movie, from lighthearted to impending doom. By the time the final scene smashes home, the comedy and adventure are gone, and the movie is summed up in Bonnie's last look at Clyde. Gratitude, love, regret, acceptance, and maybe 50 other things in there as well. The end of the movie devastates because the buildup to it is so good, we're invested. You can find more essays and criticism at mossislandsounds.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter as Moss Island, all one word. Email me at chris.board@mac.com. Thank you for listening. Until next time. The original writing from the Moss Island Sounds podcast is owned by Chris Board and Moss Island Sounds, copyright 2015. Unauthorized use and or duplication of this material without express and written permission from Chris Board is strictly prohibited. Excerpts and links may be used, provided full and clear credit is given to Chris Board and Moss Island Sounds with appropriate and specific direction to the original content.